This is the Monadnock Summer Lyceum, hosted by the Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire, and broadcast on New Hampshire Public Radio. We have some time for questions from the audience, and while the ushers collect your questions, let me begin by asking, is there a particular way or a particular practice in which you open yourself each day to the awareness of kinship? How do you open yourself to kinship and compassion?
Part of my practice is in my daily diet. I try to eat peacefully and compassionately. I've been a vegetarian for about 30 years and a vegan for about 3 years. So at least two or three times a day, I'm made mindful of my connection to the earth that provides for us. The vegan diet recommends itself to me for several reasons. It's an environmentally friendly diet. In 2006, the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization published a study titled Livestock's Long Shadow, where they determined that growing animals for agriculture is a greater driver of climate change and global warming than all forms of transportation combined: cars, trains, ships, planes. So what we eat and eating low on the food chain can make a tremendous difference to our own health and to the health of the planet. It is a healthy lifestyle. People who eat a plant-based diet tend to have fewer chronic diseases, stroke, heart disease, cancer, a lower incidence, and of course it makes all the difference in the world to all of those animals who live out their lives, if they can be called lives, in factory farms and in settings that would bring an indictment for animal cruelty if they were visited on a dog or cat, but seem to be perfectly legal and acceptable when they're inflicted upon a pig or a cow or a chicken.
Do you have any pets? And if so, how do they affect your life?
Well, I called my first dog Chinook, my spiritual guide and teacher. I said he was like a Zen master with simple wants. He would eat when he was hungry. He would sleep when he was tired. You know, animals don't worry about their stock portfolio. Not one of them is running for Congress or wants to govern the animal kingdom. They need just a little bit to be happy and satisfied. Just some clean water, a little bit of clean earth, and it's enough. And I think there's a lesson for all of us there.
How do we wrestle with and teaching others who are engaging in cruel acts against animals? Maybe laboratory experiments or trapping or large animal farms?
Well, the issue of animals in research is one that concerns me and that I've thought about a great deal. I was very heartened to see that the National Institutes of Health had decided to release most of the chimps in their captive colony and decided that these animals would no longer be used in experimentation. Chimpanzees now are going to be declared by the Fish and Wildlife Service to be protected as an endangered or threatened species, so that any studies need to benefit the chimps themselves. As far as other animals are concerned, it's a difficult topic. You know, I think the best thing that could happen in the research labs is to attain a greater degree of transparency. I have tried frequently to visit the Institutional Animal Care and Use Committee at our state's university, the University of Vermont, just to sit as a taxpayer and citizen and learn how my tax dollars are being used. What kinds of animals are subject to experiments there? What's the nature of the research? The meetings are closed to the public. It's very difficult to find out what is happening in what's supposed to be a campus atmosphere of an open exchange of information and a free exchange of ideas. So I would say opening the doors and windows to public oversight and scrutiny would be an excellent first step.
How to answer a question of a definition for heaven, a description of heaven, the question from a dying person.
What is heaven? I don't know. I don't know. And I don't think any of us knows what happens. But as a clergy person, over the course of my career, I've led many bereavement groups, grief support groups, and you hear curious stories. You hear curious stories in regard to animals, too. I had a correspondent named Stephanie who wrote to me about losing her husband. Her husband suffered a cardiac arrest, and the ambulance came with the EMTs, and they went to work on her husband. He was in the bedroom, and she was sitting with a companion in the kitchen. And as the EMTs were working on her husband, they shouted at least a couple of times, "Get the dog out of the bedroom." Well, at that point, Stephanie had two dogs, and she could see them through the plate glass window sitting out on the patio. She said, "There are no dogs in the bedroom. The dogs are here with me." And it was repeated, "Get the dogs out of the get the dog out of the bedroom." She couldn't figure it out, but then she thought, well, her husband had one special animal, as many of us do, Ginger. And perhaps that was Ginger that they saw in the bedroom with her husband waiting there to guide him across to the other side. We'll never know.
Thank you. You say that children have a natural affiliation with animals along with ancient people. When and what do you think caused our current estrangement from the natural world, from the kinship?
Well, it has a long philosophical history that you could trace to the Greeks and Aristotle and an industrial history and so forth. You know, it's interesting, in the Bible, in the book of Genesis, in chapter 2, it says that God created Adam out of the earth and gave Adam a living soul, nefesh chayim, and then saw that Adam was lonely and so created the animals to be companions to Adam. The other species weren't intended to be our possessions or commodities. They were here to be part of our broader community, according to the allegories of Scripture. And God created the animals also with nefesh chayim. God made the animals living souls, according to the book of Genesis. So there was no real distinction between the human and the non-human. But then by the time you get up to the King James Version in the 16th century, the English rendering would be God created Adam as a living soul and the others as living creatures. So somewhere between biblical times and modern times, this division that I spoke of widened and came into existence.
Is your dog a vegan?
My last dog, Smokey, was a vegetarian, and dogs do quite well on a vegetarian diet. You can buy ready-made, very healthy brands of dog food that are vegetarian, or many people make their own diets for their dogs. Cats, it's harder. Most vets think that a cat needs some meat in its diet.
Where is the boundary between sentient and non-sentient beings?
Well, that's a question, isn't it? Where's the bound between sentient and non-sentient beings? It's very hard to say. Darwin thought it went much, much lower to more simple organisms than most of us would be ready to go. Darwin thought that worms had a kind of rudimentary intelligence. You know, when I was a kid, I said I didn't care about animals or think about them, but I still remember a gift my Aunt Winnie gave me. It was a book called How Smart Are Animals. The first chapter was titled Even a Worm Can Learn, and it talked about the work of Robert Yerkes, who took a worm and trained it to do a simple tea maze. You know, if it turned left, it would hit some sandpaper and an electrode and much unpleasantness, and if it turned right, it would find the exit. Well, the worm quickly figured out no left turns allowed. But Darwin wrote a whole book about earthworms and performed a variety of experiments on them. He'd take cans of earthworms, put them on his piano, and play music to them, a little sonata. He found that worms are pretty much blind, but they're very sensitive to vibration. He was also quite interested in the habit worms have of capping their burrows. You know, they'll dig a tunnel, but then they pull a little piece of leaf or twig as a cap. No one knows quite why, but it's characteristic. Maybe it's to keep out the cold or to keep out predators. But Darwin did experiments. He'd take different kinds of leaves, and he'd even cut pieces of paper into different shapes to see how the worm would handle it as it pulled it down into its burrow. And he found that the worm would always grasp the piece of paper by the pointy end, just as you or I would if we were trying to pull an object into a narrow circular passageway. He says, yeah, the worm is acting intelligently, or what we would call intelligently, if a person were performing that same behavior. So worms, you know, they don't even have a brain. They've got a couple of nervous ganglia, but Darwin at least thought they could be brainy on occasion.
We have time for one more question. Animals exist on a diet of plants, and plants are truly dependent upon the ecosystem. Why focus just on animals?
Well, I don't focus on animals. I think we're interdependent and interconnected here. But I guess all of us have a passion that pulls at our hearts. And God bless the botanists and the horticulturists. But my passion has been animals. And as I shared this morning, that was part of my own awakening into reverence for all life.
Thank you again, Gary Kowalski. You have been listening to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum on New Hampshire Public Radio. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum presents a weekly series of lectures held at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire. For more information about the Lyceum, you can visit our website at www.monadnocklyceum.org or by writing the Monadnock Lyceum Committee, 25 Main Street, Peterborough, New Hampshire, 03458. The program next Sunday will feature August Waters with Audie Blaylock and Redline, who will be playing bluegrass music and speaking about the bluegrass celebration of an American art. Thank you again, Gary, for this interesting examination of celebrating our kinship with creation.